There, do you have any idea what you're listening to?
London Philharmonic?
It's Venus.
Huh?
Venus.
Why not? We bounced signals off the moon's surface. There's no reason that Venus shouldn't radiate impulses.
I don't mean the static. Can't you hear it, the other thing?
What other thing?
Listen to it, Paul. Listen to the voice.
Hello and welcome to Media Geek. This is your weekly look at the world of grassroots and independent media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. My name is Paul Riesenell, and I'm your host. On today's program, you might see them out on the streets of many major cities, folks selling newspapers, but not your regular daily. It's a different kind of newspaper. In Chicago, it's a newspaper called Streetwise. And we're going to learn more about this newspaper out there to help empower individuals and bring more light to the problems of poverty. You do want to stay tuned. And so, most cities have at least one newspaper. Some cities are lucky enough to have several newspapers. And oftentimes, people don't even think about another newspaper that is for sale in their city. Often sold by people who are near homeless or who have managed to get themselves out of poverty. They're often called street newspapers. And they'll feature stories about poverty, about economic issues, and about a lot of other things, too, of interest to people throughout the community. And stories that might not be covered in your regular daily newspaper. In Chicago, that newspaper is called Streetwise, and it's been around for well over a decade, sold by folks downtown and all over the place. So I want to learn more about this particular type of really, truly independent street journalism. So I had the luxury to talk with Ben Cook, a production manager at Streetwise, as well as the editor-in-chief, Suzanne Hanney. So first off, Ben was able to tell me a little bit more about what Streetwise is.
Streetwise has been a publication for going on 17 years now, and the goal of the paper is to provide opportunity for men and women who might not find it anywhere else. Monday and Wednesday, the organization has training, and anyone can come in. They don't have to have any identification. We don't care about their background, their education. We just want to give them an opportunity. And after completing a short orientation, we give them 15 free papers or magazines now and get them set up in a location. And then they are responsible after those initial free papers or magazines to keep their business going. So it's, you know, it's on their time. They are responsible to reinvest in their business and to take it seriously.
Because we're here and we've brought interest to it, other papers are starting to cover it. I think maybe readers like to know about gritty news. We get people telling us they like to read about the vendors. They like to read about our perspective on poverty. You know, the world through our vendors' eyes sometimes, how they survive.
Suzanne Hanney, editor-in-chief of Streetwise.
Typically, we'll do stories on not just homelessness, but any issue in low that has to do with low-income people, and it could even be about policy. I'm going to be doing some stories. We've done stories on schools, the school closings, because obviously if you can't afford to go to a private school, you're dependent on the public schools, and that's one thing that keeps you in Chicago. The other thing that people need to be aware of is many things can make you homeless. I mean, many people are homeless, but they're not living out on the street. They're doubled up in someone else's home because of the economy. You know, it can take, it doesn't, as we say, you know, most people live paycheck to paycheck. And so it can take any one little thing to knock you out of the ballpark. You can have an unexpected medical expenditure, an unexpected car expenditure, and that can make you late with your rent or late with your utilities, and you're already behind the eight ball, and then it doesn't take much to knock you out. So we'll typically do stories on that as well. We also do stories on entrepreneurs because, of course, our vendors are entrepreneurs. They sell the paper, and they're trying to make enough cash to make their next step.
I asked Ben Cook, production and marketing director, where the idea for Streetwise came from.
It was 1992. Judd Loschi was the person who founded the paper, and during that time it was a once-a-month publication, a black-and-white newspaper. And he was actually a little bit ahead of the curve. Right now, there are, I believe, 77 street papers or magazines like Streetwise around the world, and they started about 15 years ago. So you can see Streetwise is about a year or two ahead of the idea of creating a, you know, a magazine or a paper for people to distribute. There's a 77 publications like Streetwise around the world, and it's called the International Network of Street Papers, and Streetwise has become one of the leading voices internationally in participating in this format. This service recently started submitting original Wire content all around the world, and each week Streetwise publishes a story from one of these other street papers, whether it be Scotland or Kenya or Canada. And by doing so, we're trying to make people see this is an international problem. All countries face this in one way or another, and we're doing what we can to make it better.
Our function is to be a voice for low-income people and to be a voice for good policy, equitable policy.
Suzanne Hanney.
I think there's a lot of activism. We tend to, you know, in our calendar of events, we'll push some of the benefits that might be happening, but we also push activism in the intellectual and the old-time 60s sense. We push it every which way because we like the fact that people are involved. We want to reward their efforts. We want to reward their heart, you know? I mean, anybody who makes the city a better place is part of our niche.
Recently, Streetwise made a major change in format, going from newsprint to being a glossy magazine. Ben Cook tells us what brought about this change.
See, about a year and a half ago, the organization formed a publication committee. And we got, some board members involved, we got some community members involved, and we, you know, took survey from our customers to see what they liked, what they wanted. We really wanted to think this through. I mean, 200 men and women depend on this publication every week to, you know, help put things together in their lives. So we didn't want to do something rashly. We wanted to make sure it was well thought through. So part of it was that in 16 years, the publication had never raised its price. And in that time, paper had gotten more expensive, ink had gotten more expensive. So we had to rethink our strategies with that. Also, our advertisers wanted, you know, full color. They wanted the possibility of bleed ads. They wanted, you know, like I said, nicer paper so their ads would reproduce well. That was part of it. And also, we wanted to reformat our content a little bit. In our newspaper, sometimes our stories got a little long-winded. And it wasn't really a format that we thought you'd interact with well. So we tried to make it more user-friendly, higher quality, something our vendors could sell easier because it was a nicer product. And also when we restructured the price, we made sure that the organization would benefit in that, you know, we can keep our operating costs covered, not at a loss, and have our vendors have a higher profit per paper sales, which only helps their lives get back together that much sooner. A magazine is much, much easier to read than unfolding a huge paper, especially if it's a crowded train, you're sitting next to quite a few people. That's just not an option. I think the Tribune has been doing something like that quite recently.
We're sharpening our focus because we, with the new formatting, we are, well, smaller pages, but we're going to be doing more of them, 16 right now because of the winter and the slow season after Christmas. But we've gotten more columnists, which means we fill those pages, and then we concentrate on the cover stories, which do tend to be more social issues and always some kind of drawback to the perspective of how are people going to make it with less money, partly because of the bad economy and because it's become a great equalizer, and partly because that's always been our focus. I'm working on a story now about schools. That's my whole focus. I'm not doing any other story but that. Whereas before I might have been doing other feature stories to fill some of the other pages. Now my whole focus is calling people saying, you know, what is your story? The other thing we've done with the new paper is we've got a guest editor page. So if I'm working on a story, I might ask someone to write an advocate to write a companion piece. That's their voice. That's not mine. On my news pages, I'm trying to be totally objective and get all sides of the issue. But in this guest editor page, I might ask someone from a nonprofit or an advocacy group to write the perspective. And that's their voice. And that's, you know, me, that's not me being objective, that's them being subjective, but getting the issue out in their words, which I think is important, because if it's me always talking, it maybe is just the same kind of people saying. And I think when people hear a different wording of a story, it hits them a different way. And so that's what we're trying to do as well.
As a journalist with a great deal of experience in newspapers and journalism throughout the state of Illinois, I asked Suzanne how she came to become the editor-in-chief of Streetwise.
I graduated from Medill, and in that time they said that you had to get out of the city. I'm a Chicagoan, a native Chicagoan. I grew up on LaSalle and Division between Cabrini and the Gold Coast, so I'm like equidistant, and that was my upbringing, and I suppose that's my personality. I went to Catholic schools and then Medill, and as I said, I went downstate. I started out running a weekly newspaper 70 miles outside the city. And then I went to Dixon, Illinois, which was 100 miles west of the city. That was Ronald Reagan's hometown. I was the lifestyle editor. This was a county seat of 16,000 people, which is actually bigger than it sounds. It's the dominant newspaper in the city. And then I did a lot of historical perspectives on the city, so I became the Reagan editor when Reagan was nominated. I covered the inauguration, and I covered the economic effects of having a president from the city. I interviewed his contemporaries. I did a special edition on him. I think I did interview him once. And then I became a courthouse reporter in the neighboring county for them, and then I was news editor. And then I started a weekly for them that competed with a daily that they wanted to buy and that they ultimately did buy. From there, I went to the Quad City Times. I was a copy editor. It's a daily newspaper of 50,000 people on the Mississippi River, Illinois and Iowa. 50,000 readers, rather. The metro area was about 300,000. Then I came back to Chicago. I had a lot of family illnesses, and I worked for UPI as a freelancer in sports and for the American Banker. I was a freelancer there also. And then I came to Streetwise as a volunteer publicist, and I worked my way up. I was a copy editor, and I was a feature writer. I was city editor, and then associate editor. And then 4 years ago, I became editor. I am doing exactly what I wanted to do when I grew up. I wanted to be a journalist in Chicago and report the stories of the city. So I'm doing that.
And what difference is there between, I mean, you've seen obviously a lot of really interesting experience in a variety of different newsrooms, from smaller towns to bigger cities in Illinois, all the way to UPI. What's the difference between those experiences and now being editor-in-chief at Streetwise?
You know, the thing that strikes me off the top of my head is that it's probably a difference. In a sense, there's no difference, because the push now is local journalism. I had a speaker from Medill, Michelle Weldon, come to one of the groups. I'm president of Illinois Women's Press Association, and she spoke to our group about everyman news and, of course, the trend towards blogging and citizen journalism. And so everything is local. The closer down to the roots that you can get to asking average people what this really means to you, is what's selling now. And that's kind of basic journalism. When you go back to journalism even in the 50s and the 30s, that was the journalism that always did sell. We do a column that one of the vendors suggested called This Week in Chicago, and he goes and gets microfilm research from various old newspapers. And the one he had from a couple weeks ago was of a gambling den underneath the streets at Madison and Clark in the 30s. And it was just a really funny column. I mean, there was a steel door with a peephole and a password, and it was straight out of the movies, you know. And a daily news reporter went along chaperoned by someone. That kind of gritty story really appeals to people because it's real.
Do you think that you have maybe fewer restrictions in terms of the types of stories you can pursue?
I do. Yes, I do. I think so. I'm not sure if it's ever, never any pressure, you know, all one way, but I have a lot more freedom, I think, than a lot of papers do. Because, I know my niche, and I'm familiar with people, and my publishers trust my contacts. But I'm not totally just flying alone, either. I talk to my publisher, and I talk to my advertising person, because I will admit, I had some consultants from the University of Missouri when I started the paper that competed with the Daily. And they said, you know, your advertising people are eyes on the street. There's nothing wrong with using them. All I ever do when I talk to my advertising people is I say, okay, you know, this is our readership. This is our niche. How is this unique to our niche? And how do we make this story that you want me to do so that I don't give this person favoritism, so that I can have other people come in and do similar stories, or I can do a uniform coverage, I can cover other people the same way? Or how do I make this so that maybe I can get your person in here to do the baseline, and then I ask more people the same questions so that I get more voices? So it's always a matter of, I keep my niche in mind, and I kind of build model around it, so to speak. I build it up like a sculpture taking place. Mm-hmm.
My final question to both Ben Cook and Suzanne Hanney is, what would they like to tell the average person on the street who encounters a streetwise vendor, perhaps for the very first time?
The main thing I've heard from vendors time and time again is they don't so much care if you buy a magazine. Sure, they don't mind it, but if you just stop and talk to them for a while, standing out there in the cold or the heat or whatever for a long period of time, just having people be social with you makes their whole day, and chances are they have some fascinating stories, so it's definitely worth knowing as many vendors as possible.
I would like to tell them that we're not a charity. It's not just you're giving this person money in lieu of begging. We are a newspaper. I am a journalism grad. I've had a lot of interns from various journalism schools writing for me, so they're all getting experience, and a lot of my writers have gone on to really good papers elsewhere. So, first of all, we are a legitimate buy. The second thing is, the vendor is not a beggar. If you give them money, take the paper, because we don't want, we say we're a hand up, not a hand out. We want the vendors to be selling something, because if they can sell streetwise, they can sell anything. And typically our vendors interact with a lot of their customers, and they love the job because they're downtown meeting bankers, lawyers, judges. We had a guy who graduated from college, and he told people, and he found them giving him cards, and when they signed the cards, he found out just those were their jobs. Some of them gave him presents. They came to his graduation. He just felt tremendous support. So we want you to know that we are a legitimate business. We're trying to make the city better. We're trying to make our vendors' lives better. And we want you to consider us as an addition to the city.
And that was Suzanne Hanney, editor-in-chief of Streetwise, along with Ben Cook, the production manager of Streetwise, a newspaper you can find sold all over the city of Chicago by folks, men and women, who currently are or are at risk of becoming homeless, hoping to help folks lift themselves out of poverty. And you can find newspapers like Streetwise all over the world, all over North America, cities, everywhere, wherever you find people who are at risk of being homeless and need a little lift. You can learn more about Streetwise at streetwise.org. And you are listening to Media Geek. This is your weekly look at the world of grassroots and independent media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. My name is Paul Riesmanel, and I am your host. And Media Geek is online at mediageek.net, home to the Media Geek blog. And, of course, the radio show is at radio.mediageek.net. And if you have comments about the program, please send them to me, paul@mediageek.net. And the Twitter feed, get little bits of information about our media environment, about what's going on with Media Geek, and sometimes what's going on with me. That's twitter.com/MediaGeek. The big communications news of the week is that the House finally did pass a bill to delay the transition to digital television, something I've been talking about here on the program for many weeks now. On Wednesday, February 4th, the House voted 264 to 158 in favor of delaying the switch until June 12th. The original deadline, well, not too far away from now, was February 17th. However, many Republicans were against the switch. Representative Cliff Stearns, a Republican from Florida, said during the House debate, quote, "No matter what date you establish, there's always going to be somebody who doesn't get the message," end quote. The legislation passed by the House also allows some stations to turn off their analog signals before June, but only with permission from the Federal Communications Commission. And it's largely expected that President Obama will pass this bill, which has already been passed by the Senate. And the FCC just had an open meeting on February 5th where they discussed the transition rules. Acting FCC Chairman Michael Cobb said that the agency would carefully evaluate which stations can turn off their analog signals before the June 12th deadline. The FCC will likely allow some stations to make the switch early, but it will try to ensure that not every station in the community makes the switch early, leaving unprepared viewers with no access to over-the-air TV. He said, quote, "We reserve the right to deny those requests if we find that it would not serve the public interest or if it would frustrate Congress's goal of giving consumers adequate time to prepare," end quote. He noted that several key station groups have promised to maintain digital and analog program streams all the way until the 12th of June, including CBS, Fox, NBC Telemundo, ABC, Hearst Argyle, and Gannett. However, one of the reasons why the delay was passed was because there's a belief that some folks were still caught somewhat unawares. But the Pew Research Center's weekly survey of news consumers found that almost everybody had heard at least something about the former February 17th analog switch off. According to that survey, 97% of respondents had heard at least a little about the analog cutoff, and 81% said they'd heard a lot. Only 3% knew nothing about the switch to digital. According to the Pew survey, 77% of households say the switch will not affect TVs they use in their households, with higher income households less likely to think the conversion will affect them than lower income households. An additional $650 million is expected to be granted through the government's economic stimulus bill to complete the funding of the coupon program. And that's the coupons for the digital TV converter boxes. And indeed, that's another of the big reasons why the Congress and many public interest groups wanted to see the analog turnoff delayed, was not because people were unaware, but because the coupons, which provide you $40 discount towards one of these converter boxes, ran out, and there's now been a waiting list for pretty much since the end of 2008. And for many low-income people, the converter box coupons are pretty important to be able to maintain their regular TV service. And for those who might think, oh, why do people need a coupon? One thing to keep in mind is this is probably one of the very few federally mandated technological obsolescences to happen in modern history, where one very well-established and still very popular and well-used media services is being summarily turned off by legislative fiat in favor of another. So that is why money was set aside to help people make the conversion to digital. So we hope that some of that money will become available, be shaken loose as part of the stimulus bill, which as we go to air here, is still sitting on the Senate, still being negotiated in the Senate. And yet, Consumer Electronics Association of America says that there might be a shortage of converter boxes because the manufacturers, the member manufacturers of that group, had planned inventory based upon having a February 17th turnover date. I'm not really sure what that means. I don't know if it means that they didn't expect to sell quite so many, or whether they're hoping maybe they would have a bit of a run so they could raise prices. I don't know. But what they're advising people is if you haven't gotten your converter box and you've got an analog TV, go get it now. And while we still have a little bit of time, here's a little bit of news that you first heard it on Media Geek back on January 15th. when I had frequent guest contributor Matthew Lazar on talking about the FCC, and he had mentioned that there are rumors that FCC Commissioner Jonathan Adelstein, one of the two current Democrats on the commission, might be leaving the FCC. Well, it turns out there's a little bit more fleshing out in the rumor mill. It's not yet confirmed, but it says he might be candidate for position as the U.S. Coordinator for International Communications and Information Policy, which is a position in the State Department, formerly filled by a man named David Gross, who left the State Department on January 20th. Right now, someone named Richard Beard is currently serving in Gross's place in an acting capacity. When he was with the State Department, Gross was responsible for the formulation and advocacy of international communications policy for the United States. State's International Communication Information Policy Group advocates international policies for expanded access to information and communication technologies and improved efficiency in the international telecommunications market through increased reliance on free market forces and fair opportunities for U.S. companies to participate in the important sector around the globe. And so it may be that Jonathan Adelstein might be up to take this fairly valuable position there at the U.S. State Department. Jonathan Adelstein has filled a chair at the FCC throughout most of the Bush administration and has been generally well regarded, especially by the public interest community and by the media reform community, for having been very focused on issues of access of communications freedom of and internet freedom, in addition to having been an opponent of loosening media ownership rules and opponent of further media ownership consolidation in the United States. So that's a little bit of what's going on in our media environment. That brings to a close another edition of Media Geek. I'll be back in one more week with more news and views of our media environment. In the meantime, of course, you must check out Media Geek online at the Media Geek website, MediaGeek.net. It's home to the Media Geek blog. Been going strong with lots of news and views on our media environment going back to the year 2000. And the radio show is at radio.mediageek.net. Subscribe to the podcast, or just download it to your computer, or you can just listen there in your browser. Maybe that's the way you listen to the show, or you can catch a show if you missed it, listen to it again. All there at radio.mediageek.net. Don't forget the Twitter feed, twitter.com/mediageek. And if you are a Twitter user, if you tweet, you can tweet your comments to me there. Twitter.com/MediaGeek, or you can do it, what's the old-fashioned way now, email. Send it to paul@MediaGeek.net. Thanks for tuning in.